Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Well, the concerts here in the Royal Albert Hall yesterday and today mark the end of an era, that of Gianandrea Noseda as chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic. So if there's a tinge of sadness, he's certainly going out with all guns blazing in repertoire he's particularly championed over the last decade. Welcome to South Kensington for tonight's prom, as always, live here on Radio 3. Last night, Noseda and the Phil performed Rachmaninoff. This evening, it's a mixed bag, ending with music by a composer, the bicentenary of whose birth we're celebrating this season, Franz Liszt, but whose Dante Symphony for soprano, women's voices and orchestra has only been played twice in the whole history of the proms, the last occasion on the centenary of his death 25 years ago. In fact, all three works on the programme have one way or another been rather neglected. Beethoven's Fourth Symphony seems the unjustly ugly sister of the nine, and Saint-Saëns' Fifth Piano Concerto, The Egyptian, is being played for the first time for over 90 years at the proms, but the solo part couldn't be in more charismatic hands than those of Stephen Hough. Tonight, though, belongs to Gianandrea Noseda, and as he moves over to his new role of conductor emeritus at the BBC Phil, I ask Gianandrea what he will miss particularly about the orchestra.
I will miss enormously the fact now I feel it as my, in a good way, instrument, and so sensitive to my way of thinking the music. Now one gesture means one sound, and what they expect is something I can give immediately, and what I expect from them comes so naturally. The working atmosphere in the Studio 7, and now the orchestra moved to Media City in Salford, so in the new studio. So a new era is starting for the orchestra, but in a way I will be part of the new era of the orchestra. I will still be on board.
Gianandrea Noseda, a slender Greek maiden between two Norse giants, was Schumann's description of Beethoven's Fourth Symphony and its relationship to the Eroica and the Fifth. That position could also explain why the Fourth is relatively little known. It can simply seem dwarfed, mostly lightweight and cheerful, yet it's archetypal, muscular Beethoven, progressing with irrepressible and irresistible momentum. Beethoven had already begun his Fifth Symphony when he went for a visit to his friend Count Oppersdorf in Upper Silesia, where the court orchestra gave a performance of Beethoven's Second Symphony, already a few years old. The Count then asked him to write a new one, and to do so, Beethoven put aside the Fifth, thinking presumably that the Count would prefer something closer to the more relaxed Haydn-esque Second. The Fourth does begin, though, with a remarkable slow introduction, which seems to paint a kind of cosmic emptiness. The music accelerates into the main body of the movement, puts the dark thoughts behind it, or uses them to give it strength and unstoppable forward motion. That's still in evidence in the slow movement, despite its overwhelming tenderness in the angry outburst of the music's dark side. The scherzo has a Haydn-esque playfulness. For the first time in a Beethoven symphony, the scales enlarge to support its surroundings. The scherzo itself's heard three times, the trio twice, and the third time the scherzo appears, it's abruptly truncated by the horns, who seem to be saying, "That's quite enough of that." The spirit of Haydn remains in the scampering finale, not least in the comic, timidly slowed down version of the main theme, which appears just before the exhilarating final bars. Well, as you can probably imagine, it's a fairly warm Royal Albert Hall tonight, and it's made even warmer by the fact that it is pretty packed. And here comes tonight's guest leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Daniel Bell. Followed onto the stage here in the Royal Albert Hall by Gianandrea Noseda to conduct Beethoven's Fourth Symphony.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
Difficult to get a concert off to a high voltage start with a Beethoven symphony sometimes. We just heard one. I think it's Gianandrea Nozzeri's favourite Beethoven symphony, certainly one of his very favourites, he said. He just kissed the score at the end. Incredible dynamism. Well, that was the BBC Philharmonic and Gianandrea Nozzeri in Beethoven's fourth symphony. Of course, when they made their Beethoven cycle back in 2005 for Radio 3, it shattered records when it received almost 1.5 million downloads in just over a week. It's nice to think that when Beethoven was commissioned to write that symphony, he was having quite a good time staying with Count von Oppersdorf. He fell in love with the Count's sister, Therese. The feeling was mutual. They got engaged. Sadly, it went no further. Friends saying despite Beethoven being deeply in love, his artistic temperament meant he just couldn't make up his mind to tie the knot. Therese was apparently deeply upset, but all was still well when he wrote the symphony. Perhaps a good reason as to why it's so amiable and lovable. Gianandrea Nozzeri back on the platform, bringing the wind to their feet. Some fantastic wind solos there, and now horns, trumpets and timpani and the strings. Needless to say, with Gianandrea Nozzeri, a huge amount of energy has been expended. That's the word you first hear when you talk to members of the orchestra, energy. You never get a dull performance with Gianandrea Nozzeri, they say. Might not always work quite as he intends. I think that one did, but it's never dull. Well, it's piano move time here on the Albert Hall stage. Perhaps they'll scatter some Egyptian artifacts around for an exotic touch before we hear Saint-Saëns' fifth and last piano concerto, The Egyptian, in which the soloist will be Stephen Hough. Saint-Saëns is perhaps not so well known as having been a child prodigy, but he certainly was one, giving his first public concert at the Salle Pleyel in Paris when he was just 11, playing piano concertos by Mozart and Beethoven. Exactly 50 years later, he returned to the same venue, played the same piano concerto by Mozart, before giving the first performance of his own fifth concerto. It was the first such work he'd written for over 20 years, in which time the shadow of Wagner had fallen ever more darkly over the musical world. Saint-Saëns admitted an admiration for Wagner, but he certainly didn't want to let his style take over French music and oust its virtues of clarity and elegance. In tonight's programme, Roger Nichols suggests there was something of a coded message in Saint-Saëns' poem, which he read out at the concert, harking back to the time when, as a little boy, he dared to play Beethoven and Mozart. 50 years later, though, the message was he'd been round the block and now knew a thing or two. Well, the fifth concerto is full of Saint-Saëns at his best. Delectable melodies, incisive rhythms, colourful, translucent orchestration, real verve and some spectacular piano writing. So why, I asked Stephen Hough earlier, has this concerto not broken into the repertoire?
I don't know. It's interesting. Someone sent a tweet this morning to me saying that it was last done at the Proms in 1918. I don't know whether you can verify that.
Yeah.
Which does seem extraordinary because it's a perfect Proms piece. Saint-Saëns is interesting. He's one of these people who outlived himself in fashion because his life was long and he lived over that most revolutionary of times in human history, that the 19th century of inventions and of changes. So I think that's part of it. What I love about it is, and about Saint-Saëns' music generally, is he's always balancing beautifully the classicism. He has this classical sensibility, not just in the structures. You'll never find a development section in Saint-Saëns that outlives its welcome. It's beautifully crafted, and he treasured craft in other composers and despised those composers who didn't have it, the technique. But then there's also this marvellous ear for the exotic. And although this piece has the title The Egyptian, that's only half of the story, isn't it? Because there is the little section in the pentatonic tones with the gongs and the bells, which is obviously much further east than Egypt. And also you have in the last movement, the beginning of the last movement is a little bit, that's much further west. It's really a rag. It's a very early example of ragtime. And on top of that, of course, you get the full range of French styles. You get the wonderfully wistful modal colours of the first movement. Very little chromaticism in that movement. It's almost all white note music. And then in the last movement, you have the Folie Bergère, you have the leg-kicking can-can girls from the Montmartre, you have this wonderful sense of fun, of the best sort of camp that perhaps the French do best. It's the mousse, the soufflé, it's something that perhaps we unfairly attribute to Saint-Saëns in a large way. He certainly had a lot of that style. He was also a very serious man. So before people dismiss him as a lightweight, he was actually a heavyweight in his musical tastes and in the sort of music that he was promoting.
Stephen Half, well, Saint-Saëns loved travelling, not least to escape in winter from smog-bound Paris, which exacerbated his asthma. He began writing the concerto at home, but composed the second and third movements entirely at Luxor while on a cruise to Egypt. The first movement might be a kind of fantasia. The second's where the title Egyptian really comes into its own. It's full of impressions and memories, a translucent Egyptian morning, frogs croaking in the Nile Valley, and in Saint-Saëns' own words, a Nubian love song, which I heard sung by the boatman on the Nile as I went down the river in a boat. Apparently he'd no paper to hand, so he wrote the tune on his shirt cuffs. And as for the brilliant virtuosic finale, well, Saint-Saëns imitates the thud of his ship's propeller as the sunlight glitters on the water. He admitted not everyone shared his pleasure in the vagaries of the ocean, but that this music was painting his joy in a sea crossing. Well, the piano has been moved. The heave and the hoe have been heard. The tuning has been taken from the piano A. And we just await Stephen Half with Gianandrea Noseda. And here they come, joining the BBC Philharmonic on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall. Broad grin on Stephen Half's face to perform Saint-Saëns' fifth piano concerto, The Egyptian. Saint-Saëns' fifth piano concerto, The Egyptian, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by Stephen Huff, with the BBC Philharmonic conducted by Gianandrea Noseda. When Berlioz heard the young Saint-Saëns play, he said he's an absolutely shattering master pianist. I think after that performance, you might say the same about Stephen Huff, who's coming back with a fez. Absolutely trying to be deadpan, but a bit of a grin, which he now removes to bow. Saint-Saëns called that piece a musical journey through the Orient to Egypt and beyond, and it's certainly an exhilarating one. Gianandrea Noseda bringing the BBC Philharmonic to its feet and punching the air, really. Can't understand why it hasn't been performed here at the Proms for 93 years. It is very warm here tonight, and I think both men are, well, the whole orchestra, of course, as well, suffering a little bit. Stephen Huff just wiping his hands and his mouth occasionally with a handkerchief just to sort of keep the worst of it at bay. Well, he'll be thinking possibly now. He's only got one more concert at the Oxford Festival, and he's got a month off. Mind you, he is moving in New York. He's got a week's holiday in Morocco. And even while he's going to New York, he'll be orchestrating his own mass to be played by the Indianapolis Symphony next April. No end to this man's talents. Here he comes back again onto the platform. Stephen Huff applauding the orchestra as he comes. A bit more, I think. That's the magic of the Albert Hall. You can hear a pin drop when somebody plays something simple as well as that. That was Stephen Huff's own arrangement of a matinee song called Crepuscule, Twilight. Back comes Stephen Huff. I asked him whether he was going to be composing in the summer. I think he thinks with his New York move and so on, perhaps not so much. He's doing that orchestration. Then he's got 6 weeks touring in Australia, a programme of Beethoven, Liszt, Scriabin, and his own, Stephen Huff's sonata. Well, Saint-Saëns and Liszt were friends, and after the interval, the BBC Philharmonic and Gianandrea Noseda visit hell and purgatory, as graphically portrayed in his Dante Symphony by Liszt, the bicentenary of whose birth this BBC Proms is celebrating. And for the next 20 minutes, we make our way down to the Royal College of Music, where earlier this evening, Louise Fryer discussed Liszt with Stephen Huff and Malcolm Hayes.
Stephen, I'd like to start with you. You've performed Liszt's music extensively, you've recorded it, you've written about it, and he was just simply an extraordinary character, wasn't he? In one of the articles I came across, he's been described as the Justin Bieber of the 1830s. I wonder what it was about him that made him such a musical storm in that time.
I think it's hard to say simply because he did so many things so well and started so many things. You know, he was at the beginning not only of the 19th century, which is probably the most extraordinary century in human history in some ways, but he was at the beginning of the development of the piano as a new big romantic instrument. He was at that point in musical history where individualism was taking over and no longer were composers writing for kings and bishops. They were writing for themselves, that sort of big romantic movement in music. And so, in a sense, he had an advantage because he had a clean piece of paper in front of him. But my goodness, what he made of that is absolutely extraordinary as a pianist and also as a composer and as a conductor, of course. He's one of the first people to be a conductor of other people's music, not just of his own.
Malcolm, were there signs early on in his life that he was going to become this great charismatic musician?
There was obviously something extraordinary about him from a very early age. The phenomenon of the extreme child prodigy is not actually that rare. It happens quite a lot. And then as now, you know, child prodigies touring Europe was quite big business. You know. And Liszt's father, who seems to have been a very nice, balanced man, understood his son very well, but made quite sure that he was already at age about 10. You know, he was doing European tours and things like that. Not overexploited, but he clearly wanted this extraordinary talent to be put through the mill very young, but not to be overexposed. But as I say, there are a lot of child prodigies. It's not that unusual a thing. What seems to have been extraordinary about Liszt was not just the fact that he was so consistently a remarkable player, even at that age, and had this unreal virtuosity from pre-teenage years. But there was something else. There was something mesmerizing about his playing, something haunting. You hear when he was even about 14 and playing in Paris to probably a very well-heeled audience. And they were completely, I mean, clearly, if you even heard him then, just once, your life was different afterwards. There was something about it, some kind of magic, which is not in the end to do with virtuosity at all, it's something else. And he had that as well, and he seems to have had it really right from the beginning of his life, right through to his old age. That's much more unusual.
You mention his father, who's almost a kind of Leopold Mozart figure.
Much wiser and nicer man, actually.
I'm relieved to hear it. When he died, what kind of impact did that have on Liszt?
Yes, Liszt was only 16 when his father died. They were in Paris, where then, as now, was one of the big capitals for music, and so that was where he was going to be for a bit. And his father died very unexpectedly, got typhoid and just died. This is the sort of thing which happened then. You know, we would think, no, that was very unusual. But then child mortality was not such a huge problem as it was, say, in Mozart's day. But, you know, your father suddenly carried off at 16. You wouldn't necessarily expect that. And he kept himself going. He was obviously very unhappy about it. His mother was there to look after him. But he became a very introspective teenager indeed. Taught pupils, but didn't go out much. And so in that respect, it was a normal childhood. He became a normal, moody teenager. He reacted, I think he found it very, very difficult, but such was his talent and such was his self-sufficiency as an artist and a person, already a very mature human being, age 16, he was able to cope.
He went to Paris and he saw Paganini perform. What kind of inspiration was Paganini for him, Stephen?
Well, it seems that he just opened up the idea of, well, I think two things. One is just the sheer virtuosity of playing an instrument to a degree that was not thought possible until that person. But I think the other point that Malcolm made is about the personality of someone like Paganini, the ability for him to transfix the audience, even sometimes to a rather fearful degree. You know, we think of people who have magnetic personalities. It's not always a good thing. There have been some political leaders in the 20th century who had very magnetic personalities and used it for great evil. So I think this is something that Liszt saw in Paganini and decided that he wanted to do the same for the piano that Paganini had for the violin. And he did, of course, and much more.
How did he go about transforming the role of a concert pianist?
Well, of course, a concert pianist didn't really even exist when Liszt was beginning. piano recitals didn't happen. People took part in concerts with many different artists appearing, singers and maybe an orchestra playing a movement of a symphony or whatever. Liszt was the first person, although not in his teens, but later on, to play a whole evening of piano music by himself, and also in profile to the audience. This is not just because perhaps he had a rather beautiful profile, but also because the piano was no longer sort of part of the stage of the orchestra. It was a solo instrument. It was bigger than it had been before. And the sound, of course, reflected on the lid of the piano, went out into the hall. Liszt was creating bigger sounds on the piano. The piano makers were making bigger sounds. The whole thing was augmenting in every way. And Liszt was absolutely there at the center of all of this.
Was somehow the instrument calling out for a figure like Liszt?
Yes, I mean, one must include Chopin, of course, in this. I mean, Chopin had a very different role, but an equally important role, and Liszt would have been the first to admit this. I think Liszt was not envious of Chopin, but in a sense he understood how single-heartedly Chopin was refining Chopin's own music in a way that perhaps Liszt never quite got round to doing. Liszt had too many ideas to concentrate on any of them to perfection, in a way.
Do we know what Liszt thought of Chopin?
From what we know, there is, first of all, his book about Chopin, which he wrote after Chopin had died. When I say wrote, it was dictated to his then, well, the second great love of his life, Princess Caroline, Sayn Wittgenstein. And his habit in those days, when writing in any sense, he would dictate it either to her or to someone else, and then go over it. And when he was happy with it, that he would then put his signature to it. There is a later edition of the book, which is actually full of Princess Caroline. It's a revised edition and full of a great deal of very extraneous stuff, I'm afraid. But the first one is interesting because it's pretty high-flown, but he's genuinely talking about Chopin and not just about himself. That's what he says. And the very fact that it exists is interesting, that, you know, is there another great composer who's written a book about another one? I don't think so. It's not usually what they make the time to do. So that, and a lot of the things he says, he very much admired the seriousness of Chopin's artistry and clearly understood very well that they were, apart from living at the same time and both playing the piano, they were very, very different people. It would have been as wrong artistically and personally, I think, for Chopin to charge around Europe doing what Liszt did. It would also have killed him because he had tuberculosis, and so he would have died even younger than he did. And it would have been equally wrong for Liszt to shut himself up like Chopin and just write, you know, a small number of pieces with great fastidious care. And whether Chopin understood that as well about Liszt, I'm not so sure. If he lived, of course, because they were great friends when they were young in Paris, and then they fell out for this or that reason, not terribly seriously. If Chopin had lived, perhaps they would have got back together again. It would be nice to think so. But certainly I think Liszt understood why Chopin was that way very, very well.
I think it's also important to pick up the point about expanding pianos. It's not just so a piano can play more powerfully in a sense of virtuosity. It's also so a piano can truly become a singing instrument. Because before the pianos of the mid-19th century, a note would die very quickly. Once a note could sing through, then you could have these lines spun like an opera singer. In fact, very much an influence on both Chopin and Liszt. The bel canto style. And so that's a further thing, and it picks up again what Malcolm said about virtuosity is not just playing loud and fast. Virtuosity is about a compelling person at the instrument and also about how you use the instrument in every way, the pedaling, which was also developing, the singing sound, the balancing of chords and so on.
How do you feel when you know you're going to play Liszt or Chopin? Do they produce very different sensation in you?
Actually, they do, yes. I think Chopin is someone that it doesn't really matter if you don't know anything about him as a person, particularly. I think the music speaks for itself completely. I think if you know nothing about Liszt, you probably wouldn't understand the music as well. Because when you play Liszt, you have to become Liszt in some sort of way. There's a certain extravagance of gesture, there's a certain theatricality, in the very best sense, sometimes edging towards something of a slight vulgarity, perhaps. Never mind, it's wonderful. People who love Liszt love everything about him. And I think you do need that big sense. You know, it's not music for a small canvas. It's big-boned and it's big-visioned music in every way.
And I think perhaps the sheer range of his interest, too. I mean, he read an enormous amount. seems to have been very interested in that. But also there was a lot of travelling, not always just for work-related reasons. The time he spent in Switzerland when he was really quite young, so there he is writing Swiss landscape pieces beautifully, with literary connections, of course, Italy as well. He was so plugged in to all these things around him and saw so much of the world, whereas Chopin didn't, because, again, for health reasons, he really couldn't. He had to be much more in the one place. And I think you sense the difference between the two composers' output there, that really Liszt has been able to put the whole of the 19th century, geographically almost, as well as literature, really into his own music. Not what Chopin would have felt he was there to do.
So in many ways, we travel with Liszt. We see the world through his eyes, through his music.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Of course, Chopin didn't write pieces with any descriptive titles, whereas Liszt wrote few pieces without descriptive titles. That's one very clear distinction between the two. Liszt perhaps was always reaching beyond the music to other visions, to other trying to depict something. In that way, he was a painter and a poet. Chopin, in a way, was just a musician. I mean, an extraordinary one, but I think it was a very different scope, in a way.
Do you keep those images in mind when you're performing?
Not really, although I suppose in the Swiss Année, it's hard not to feel. I was just in Verbier last week, and I was looking out over the mountains and thinking that this was not so far from where Liszt himself would have been. And I think there's a sense in which Vallée d'Obermann has the immensity of scope. But I generally don't have visual pictures in my mind when I'm playing, no.
Malcolm, fill us in on exactly why Liszt left Paris and went to Switzerland.
Well, yes, it was. I think it was probably thought to be the wise thing to do. He had found himself, I think rather to his own astonishment, in the beginnings of a serious relationship with the Countess Marie Dagout, who was a bit older and was married with two children. And he'd managed to land himself with a number of fairly easy liaisons with quite willing, younger, married countesses early on. That all came very easily to him. It would not be fair, I think, to say he was a sort of predatory Don Juan. He wasn't like that at all. But if it was going to be easy and he was young, he was going to enjoy that, and he did.
There was a whole thing called Liszt mania, wasn't there? It was a recognised medical condition.
Yeah, I think it was, yes, possibly. We'll probably come to that in a moment. but clearly, he knew very well with Marie that they both realised they were on the verge of something serious, which was extremely difficult for both of them, not least for her. And she decided to leave her family and go and be with him. And then, just to make things even more difficult, her youngest, one of her children, two children, died. So that very obviously put the whole thing on hold and produced an enormous crisis in both of them. They didn't see each other for several months and eventually did see each other again, and they decided that they just, you know, they needed to be together. So even by the standards of 1830s Paris, that really would have been thought to be a bit ripe, you know. So they decided to decamp to Switzerland, then as now, you know, a neutral country. They couldn't actually be, frankly, extradited from there. There was nothing anyone could do about it. That was why they went there immediately. Not only that, Marie had literary ambitions with very good reasons. She had a real writing talent, very difficult for a woman in 1830s Paris to pursue that, and she wanted to do that. He was also being encouraged by her to read more, and already Switzerland was a place to go for the romantic imagination, all those mountains, all those waterfalls. Goethe had been putting all this on the map several decades beforehand, so they would certainly have thought, look, there's lots for us to compose about and write about here. So there was that reason too. But if this relationship hadn't happened, would he ever have gone there? We can't know, possibly not.
So do you think, Stephen, there are musical advantages from the fact that Liszt couldn't stay in Paris and continue to perform? He had to withdraw, in a sense.
I'm not sure at that point in his life that the musical advantage is so clear. There certainly are by the time we get to the Weimar period, when he stops playing, in fact, really, and dedicates himself to more serious musical ends. But I think at this particular point, probably it's still manuscripts in suitcases, and I'm not sure that's the best way for any composer, really, to work.
We left him running away to Switzerland, if you like, with Marie Dagout, and they had children together.
Three children. Blandina was born in Geneva. Cosima, who later became Wagner's wife, born in Como. Not on Christmas Day, she liked to say, but the day before, actually. Quite interesting, some biographer dug that up. And then Daniel, who was born in Rome. And listen, his children, yes, he's been criticised. He seems to get criticised for everything, doesn't he? Funny. You know, nobody criticizes Bach for anything. Why does Liszt get picked on in this way? But anyway, he does. It's one of those things. But because he and Marie Dagoo split up not so very much later, once the excitement of the romance had died down a bit, I think they realized their temperaments were very different in many ways. It was a great thing while it lasted. There's no question about that. It wasn't superficial. But she went back to Paris, and he was charging around all over Europe playing the piano. And the children were sort of looked after by this or that babushka or Parisian equivalent, and later Liszt's mother, who stayed on in Paris and after her husband had died, and looked after them. Granny was clearly a great thing in the children's lives. Did he neglect them? I don't think he did by the standards of the time. He always provided for them with his money, certainly wrote to them always. You could say that he neglected them more than he should have. Problem was that because of the rift between him and Marie was so great, it was very difficult to have a sort of rapport which he would have liked. But he seems to me to have been very fond of them, and when they did get a bit older and came to see him at Weimar, there was some... He liked having his routine disrupted by this lot. You know, they all seemed to have got on with him and with other children who were around at the time, from his second inamorata, Princess Caroline. She had a daughter who was slightly older, and it seems to have been a really rather happy, free-wheeling household. So how he must have felt when, first of all, Daniel died, age 19. Nothing could have been done about tuberculosis. And he was the really bright one, academically very, very good, studying as a lawyer, could have done very, very well. And then his marriage to Princess Caroline didn't happen because of basically intrigues by her own family, her own husband, and who all wanted to keep a handle on as much of her own money as they could, and complicated intrigues in the Vatican relating to this, but it didn't happen. And then a year later, Blandina, the oldest daughter, who had married a bright young lawyer in France and was doing very, very well, had a child, everyone was very happy, and then she got an infection and died. And that really did devastate him, I think. I mean, as if he wasn't unhappy enough about Daniel. The memorial pieces he wrote for each of them tell you something about that. And I've always got the feeling that those 3 years, when you get three hammer blows like that, something went out of his life. He was not the same. One of the reasons he took minor orders in the Catholic Church, I'm sure, was because he felt, you know, people who matter most in my life are gone. You know, one relationship's broken up, two children are dead. The marriage of the other one is impossible, you know, clearly not going to happen. He needed a kind of emotional center, a spiritual center in his life. And I think it was his way of reconfirming the Catholic faith he'd always had from very, very young. I don't think we can underestimate just how much the loss of those two children really did affect him. He didn't talk about it much, because that wasn't his way. But it must have, I think you can tell.
Stephen, what do you think of the spiritual side of Liszt's music? As Malcolm says, his devotion to the church was apparent even when he was a child.
Yes, it isn't something that he sort of had a wild youth and then discovered religion in midlife, although he certainly came back to it in a very serious way. But yes, it was always a theme. But I think he even considered priesthood, you know, as a teenager, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he did. His father had considered it and actually did enter a monastery and train for the priesthood, and then found, as many people very honorably and honestly do, that actually it was too severe and it wasn't quite what he was meant to do. So he got married and had Liszt, so I suppose we can be grateful for that. An only child, interesting in those days, large families, but Liszt was an only. So no wonder, you know, his mother thought he was special. I don't know how seriously Liszt thought about the priesthood. There were times when he was about 16 when he thought he did, but he was being a moody adolescent. And he didn't actually, when he was older, he did not think, I think, seriously of entering the priesthood. The four minor orders he took, they did not preclude marriage. I mean, he could have got married in that way if he wanted to. He could also have left quite easily. It's not like leaving the full priesthood, which is a very serious thing. So there's no evidence he thought of it as a sort of apprenticeship. But it was a statement to himself and to the world, and I'm sure he felt to God, about where now the center of gravity in his life and in his music was to be.
I feel we've barely scratched the surface, and before you go today, please thank my guests, Stephen Huff and Malcolm Hayes.
Very who's Friar at the Royal College of Music. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handy, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. And tonight, the BBC Philharmonic is bidding farewell to its chief conductor for the last 9 years or so, Gianandrea Noseda. And they do so in music by the composer we've just been hearing about, and of whom Gianandrea is such a powerful advocate, Franz Liszt. The orchestra's joined by the soprano Julia Doyle, the Women's Voices of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Chorus, for a performance of Liszt's Dante Symphony. It's a work it took a lot of Liszt's life. In his mid-20s, he was living in Rome with Countess Marie d'Agoult, and her literary interests, coupled with his love for Italian scenery and cultural heritage, encouraged him to write a Dante sonata for piano. Fast forward 8 years to when Liszt decided to end his concert career as a pianist and spend more time composing. He turned back to his Dante idea and to writing a symphony based on the medieval Italian poet's Divine Comedy, his allegory of the Christian soul's journey towards God. Liszt played bits of it to his new girlfriend, Princess Caroline Sayn-Wittgenstein. At that stage, he was envisaging a performance of lantern slide projections of scenes from Dante's poem and using a wind machine to summon up the winds of hell. Not enough money to do that in the end. But it was another 8 years before Liszt began putting the symphony together. He wrote to his friend Wagner. He wanted to dedicate to him a three-movement symphony based on the three parts of the poem, Hell, Purgatory, and Paradise, which would include a choral finale. A few months later, Liszt travelled to see Wagner with his score, or at least the score of the first two movements, Hell and Purgatory. Wagner liked what he heard, except for the resounding choral ending. He wanted the music to finish with a fine, soft shimmer, rather than a majestic deity. Liszt blamed Caroline and said he'd alter it, and that's how the symphony will end tonight, with the shimmer. There's also the story that Liszt was still intending to write a paradise movement, and Wagner dissuaded him, claiming you simply couldn't write music describing paradise. Well, like the Saint-Saëns concerto we heard before the interval, the Dante Symphony is a rarity in the concert hall. It's only had two Proms performances. I asked Gianandrea Noseda to extol the work's virtues.
It's very difficult for a composer to touch probably one of the biggest and the greatest masterpiece in literature, the Divine Comedy, and to try to tell something important, something beautiful about it. And Liszt could catch the spirit of Dante, at least from the Italian point of view. When I conduct the Inferno, the first movement, it really sounds like very anguish, a lot of anxiety, with the claustrophobic feeling. You are there, you cannot escape. Also, the depiction of the love between Paolo and Francesca, which is the midsection of the first movement, is so well-crafted, so tender in a way. And the contrast is so huge if you compare all the anguish of the damned souls. So it's fantastic. And the Purgatorio, the second movement, is really try to point out the way where we have to go. The last 5 minutes of the Purgatorio, the piece at least called Magnificat, is the end of a journey going to the paradise. Probably it's not the paradiso yet, but now we are sure to get there.
So now here once again comes Gianandrea Noseda to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Liszt's Dante Symphony, beginning at the gate of hell with its inscription, "Abandon all hope, you who enter here," intoned by the brass to the speech rhythms of the Italian text.
Thank you.
Liszt's Dante Symphony, ending on a chord that seems to reach upwards to paradise, surrounded by a distant halo of alleluias. That was just the third performance of that music in the whole history of the Proms, given here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, by the soprano Julia Doyle and the women's voices of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra Chorus, Chorus Master Simon Halsey, and the BBC Philharmonic guest leader Daniel Bell, conducted for the very last time in the concert as his capacity as chief conductor by Gianandrea Noseda. Chorus and Julia Doyle right up at the top in the gallery of the Royal Albert Hall. Marvellous effect, as always, with that distant chorus. Well, if you've missed some of tonight's concert or would like to hear it again, then it's repeated this Thursday, 4th of August at 2 p.m. on Radio 3. And, of course, it's available on the Radio 3 website for a whole week from now. What a stunned auditorium after that Liszt piece. Extraordinary first movement. All that sound and fury signifying quite a lot. And then the gradual ascent. And here comes Julia Doyle, made her way down from the gallery. Seven bars, but very important bars. Then Andrea Noseda behind her, again turning to the gallery and the ladies of the CBSO chorus applauding the orchestra. It's a long distance applause going on there. And the BBC Phil comes to its feet. Then Andrea will be going into the studio up in Manchester with them at the end of this week to finish a Casella CD, an Italian music series, the Concerto for Orchestra. He's back in this country for the War Requiem, Britain's War Requiem, the LSO, also taking that to New York in October, and the Beethoven Mr. Solemnis with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment he's looking forward to, and he begins his new job, if you like, as chief guest of the Israel Philharmonic. All that after the Streza Festival and a little bit of a holiday. But for the moment, he's taking the applause here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, you can catch two Proms tomorrow evening live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and at their heart, the season's commemorations for the 50th anniversary of the death of Percy Grainger. At a 10:15 in the late night concert, Northumbrian small pipes player Catherine Tickell and friends put his achievement into its folk music context. And earlier at 7, Sir Andrew Davis and the BBC Symphony Orchestra give the first Proms performance of Grainger's hugely inventive suite In a Nutshell. It's teamed with Richard Strauss's portrait of the adventures of another rascal, if you consider Grainger one such, Till Eulenspiegel, and Tasmin Little is the soloist in Elgar's great violin concerto. That's tomorrow. Back comes a slightly weary-looking Gianandrea Noseda, but a huge roar and huge applause and huge stand-bashing from the members of the BBC Philharmonic. I think Gianandrea, who's just blown a kiss at them, is, well, hand on heart. There's emotion on both sides. Members of the orchestra were telling me that in the interval. Things go better and worse throughout 9 years, but at the end, he's a fine musician, a fine conductor, and he's a very straightforward, nice guy. And that's important. Well, for now, time to leave the Royal Albert Hall for the calmer regions of Broadcasting House, where Jonathan Swain's waiting to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as he was saying, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom again on Thursday afternoon, this coming Thursday afternoon, at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
The Proms is, as we know, the world's greatest festival of music, stretching from now to September like a note that's held and held and held. And I reckon the Proms Poetry Competition is one of the world's greatest poetry competitions, stretching your imagination from now to the closing date of August the 6th. What we'd like to do is write a poem, in any style, on a piece of music that's performed at this year's Proms. You can react to the music in all sorts of ways. It could evoke a memory. It could make you feel something abstract and profound. Or you could pen a sonnet on the way the conductor moves on the podium in the same way your Auntie Mabel moved as she hung out her washing. There are three age groups, 7 to 11, 11 to 18 and 18 upwards. I'm the judge, along with the former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen, and I can't wait to read your entries.
Well, now there's a challenge for you, and you can read more about the competition on the Radio 3 website. Well, in 3 minutes or so this evening, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht talking tonight to the German bass baritone Thomas Quasthoff, one of the finest leader singers performing today. That's at 10. Until then, an example of Quasthoff in song. This one by Brahms. It's based on a Moldavian folk song. Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen. Not to visit you anymore. I resolved it and I vowed it. And yet I go every evening. The pianist was Justus Zion.
Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen, beschloss ich und beschwor.
One of Brahms' Lieder und Gesänge, Opus 32, Nicht mehr zu dir zu gehen, not to visit you anymore. The bass baritone Thomas Quasthoff and the pianist Justus Zion. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 minute past 10. And now Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht interview.
Thomas Quasthoff is probably the finest leader singer performing today. Not my opinion, but the view of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, voiced in a previous Lebrecht interview. Quasthoff has both the high intelligence and the talent for intimacy required by this most taxing of art forms. He can shrink a 3,000-seat hall into the palm of his hand, and his deep bass baritone voice has a velvet quality that lends comfort to the mortal agonies he evokes in song. He's a unique artist, widely beloved, winner, too, of the Herbert von Karajan Prize. Visually, the striking thing about him is that he's just 4 foot tall, with very short arms, the legacy of a drug called thalidomide that his mother was prescribed during pregnancy. Born in 1959 and raised first in a pediatric ward, then in a home for cerebral palsy sufferers, he survived against medical odds through an iron strength of will, a ribald wit, and the love and support of his close-knit family, most crucially, his elder brother, Michael. He worked as a radio announcer in Hanover before winning a singing competition in 1988 and becoming a sought-after performer and teacher. As well as classical repertoire, he's recorded jazz for Deutsche Grammophon. He married a television journalist from Leipzig, Claudia Stelzisch, and became stepfather to her daughter. Last year, his brother died suddenly and his marriage ended. But there's a happy ending. We meet at his home in Berlin on a street named for a great philosopher, Schopenhauerstraße. Thomas Quasthoff, Schopenhauer, on the whole, was a pessimist, but he took the view that the world is what we make of it, an expression of human will, individual will. Does that in any way reflect your personal outlook?
That was one book in my growing period from Ernst Bloch. It's Prinzip Hope,
The principle,
which I read quite a few times. And I would definitely say that this is philosophically more the direction I want to go, because, of course, everybody who is really meeting me the first time is a little bit showing. I mean, you are one of the rare ones who were really so natural and normal, but I feel that there is an insecurity in getting in contact with me. And I think that I got from, who knows, a kind of mentality which really creates bridges. Riccardo Muti said, of course, I thought so many times, how do I have to give him the hand? And then I met you and everything was gone. Yeah, I had the feeling that there is a normal person, only smaller. My wife is saying this also. I mean, Tommy, you are only shorter, but not disabled in a mental way or in any other ways.
What's your first memory as a child? Where are you?
The real first memory is really when I was lying in a cast, because my foot standing after my birth backwards and they have to
reverse it.
So I lay 1.5 years permanent in a cast, and I could still paint the curtains of the room, and I remember that the walls were yellow and there was a door with a window on top, and I was 9 to 10 months old and everybody's saying, you cannot remember this, and I said, yes, I can.
And are you alone in the room, or is there someone?
No, I don't even remember how many we were, but I think we were 6. 3 beds on one side and 3 on the other.
Your parents hadn't wanted to send you to the hospital. They were told to by the medical authorities, who still knew nothing about your condition and were worried of infections and so forth. Germany in 1959 was still a very rigid society. Is that how you felt it growing up in Hildesheim?
Well, Hildesheim is a small city, famous for the churches and for the church music. And even in my house, there was always music. I mean, my father studied music too, singing, by the way. Only the problem was after the war, all the theaters were broken, and the stepfather of my father said, a very nice guy, what a horrible profession. Then he changed finally, but I think in his deepest inside, he wanted to give me the chance to fulfill the dreams that he couldn't fulfill.
As a singer.
I don't even also think that he would have the strength in staying in this profession, because I always say a nice voice is one attitude that you need, but that's not what you need really to make a career. There is a lot more. Good nerves, intelligence, and yeah, many things. And my father was really, with my mother, very, very supportive when they realized, even with 3, that I was able really only to listen to a record once and I could repeat it. Without understanding the words, of course, but I did. So they realized that there is a talent. And they gave me then, when I was 13, the chance to put this in more professional directions without any clue of the fact that that maybe would be a profession or something like this. It was really like my brother played table tennis and I sang. Yeah, it was a normal hobby and we drove once a week to my teacher and I had my lesson and then we went home and that's it.
This thalidomide disaster, which in our country was fought by the newspapers, and there was some compensation eventually for the parents. Here in Germany, there was very little compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Did
we get 25,000 marks? That was all. Yeah. So
it's about 8,000 euros.
This is better, of course, now, because the rent is much, much higher up.
The rent?
The money that I get per month.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. And yesterday I got a letter that the money will be raised from next month on 0.99%. This is, I think, 20 euros. Well, what a deal.
This is the interest.
Yes. I mean, on the other side, I mean, this Contergan organization which exists...
Contergan was the German name for thalidomide.
Yes, it's always, of course, asking me that I should be on front fighting for this. And I said, you know, I would have a very bad feeling because I'm earning really with my singing and my professorship so much money. And if I would go, we need more money. I mean, we have to have people there in front who are really fighting for their existence and who really have big health problems and things like this. And comparing to this, my life is really, thank God, on very stable fundament, which is really very good.
Did your mother carry a sense of injustice, of anger, of rage against the system that did this to her?
I think all her life she felt in a way guilty, but definitely not because I said, why did you? Never. I think I showed her many times in taking her with me on concerts that there is no need to have thoughts like that. I always tried my best, not in school, but if somebody would have told me 25 years ago that I would have a professorship at a music university, I would definitely say, you're crazy. But I mean, I did. And I love to teach. And even if I stop singing, there is always a kind of work where I know this will go further, even if I'm not singing anymore, because I definitely will not make the mistake to stay with 70 on stage and going young singers on their nerves.
Politically, you're on the left. You've described yourself once as an old red fighter. Where does that come from?
Bruno Walter said, if a musician is not loving music and deep inside not really a kind of communist and activist for human rights, then he is not a musician. And I think Bruno Walter is really very right with this. I think if you grow up in a very conservative world, where very important was what the neighbors thinking, where these kind of ritual car washing on Saturday in a white undershirt standing in front of the car, especially with the education in the school, I grew up on a humanistic gymnasium where I had old languages like Greek and Latin, and we had really also a history lessons with teachers who were really modern and really progressive in thinking, which I'm still very, very thankful. I mean, I was 10 when we realized this kind of student demonstration against Shah Pahlavi and things like this, and Onuzok died on the street.
Yeah, 1969.
So, yes, yeah. And of course, we were very, very part of the terrorist times. And of course, there was also a kind of opinion. I mean, I was always against violence, but I could understand where that came from. Yeah, I mean, violence is never the right way, but there were structures in the state, also in Germany, which had to be changed. And they did. I mean, even the student demonstrations really changed a lot in the relation between the students and the institutions of universities, which was very, very good and very helpful.
And you were following this at 10 years old?
Not very active, but it started. I mean, of course. And I mean, my brother was 2 years older than me. So every Sunday we had this kind of violent discussions with my father, who permanently tried to educate the two sons to conservative young men, but he failed with my brother and me. And we were not really this kind of violent left people, but we had a very intensive sense for Gerechtigkeit,
justice.
And this is still going on now. I mean, now I'm a professor and now I see
You're part of the establishment.
No. Of course I am. Yeah, but I'm the freak of this establishment, I would say. But on the other side, I see that, honestly, the students has more rights than a professor in many ways, where you really think, okay, big change, but in many ways for good.
In the wonderful memoir that you wrote with your brother, which was unfortunately not published in our country, you make childhood sound full of mischief and fun.
Yes.
That you were the one that made everybody laugh.
Yes.
And
still.
Still.
I love to watch and I love to, let's say, beobachten.
Observe.
To observe people. This is really very nice. And with the disability that I have, I think I have a very intensive sense in understanding people very fast. The way they look into your eyes, the way they behave, the body language. It's very interesting. I mean, definitely if I would not be a singer, I think I would be a psychiatrist, because I think there are not many things which are so interesting than the human soul. And I think one of the reasons is really that my parents really didn't handle me like a handicapped person. Yeah, I was a child like everyone. I had a big mouth. I was a little lazy in school. And it was also not easy with my father, because he was always very afraid that I make my Abitur. And because you cannot really work as a street worker or doing something with your hands. When I was 15, I didn't understand. Now I do. There was also a permanent pressure, really, also in school, which they never do with music, which was very interesting. I mean, they always said, Tommy, it's your decision. If you work, it's fine. If not, with your talent, your decision. And finally, that was the right way in handling this, because I worked a lot.
Tell me about your brother. I mean, it sounds like an almost ideal companionship between the two of you.
Yeah, we had a very unusual relationship. My brother was one of the most nicest, smartest, educated, persons on earth. I mean, I trusted him 100%. He trusted me 100%. We had similar hobbies. He played a few instruments. He was writing texts, which I sang a lot of. One of the songs that he wrote is also on my last jazz recording. And he was even there when I produced it, with no hair and very thin. And it was half a year before he died. And so I lost not only a brother, I lost really my absolutely best friend and the person I mostly trusted. And besides of all, he had a big sense of humor, which we also shared in many ways. My mother always said, to be together with one of yours is really very nice, but if you are together, then it's getting crazy. But it was a mixture. I mean, we had very often very serious talks, but my brother was not a person who opened his soul very much to other people. I mean, I was much more expressive and opened, sometimes too open. But I learned, and we had a very, very special relation. It was a big shock when he died last year.
Did you fight? Were there jealousies? Did you envy his physique?
Between us?
No, never.
No. I was always admiring him for his writing, because I think still that he was really brilliant, a brilliant writer. But he had no talent, honestly, he had no talent to sell himself. And I always wanted to do it, and he said, if you do it, I'm angry with you, because this is my life, and he was right. And I accepted, finally, because he was right. I mean, would I allow another person's really to tell me what I have to do? Very rarely. Maybe my wife or very, very close friends, but generally I think I take my own decisions, which I think they're good or not.
You wrote the memoir together?
Yes.
Was that easy?
98%, yes. 2%, no. There are some parts in the German version, especially, where he was writing about other singers in a very, very, very ironic way. I would say even in a bad way, in many ways, that I wouldn't publish, but he insisted to let it in, and we had some arguing about it. But I mean, finally, yes, it was easy. Very easy. And nobody knew me better than my brother, I mean, of course. And I think he really attached my way of living and my character really very nice in this book.
Yes, he does. Are there more songs of his that you want to sing?
I just got a recording from his songs, and we will see. We anyway will have some serious talks with the DG and checking where the way is going. I had a big wish to make one kind of country recording, which I think would be really very nice. You know, I love to...
Thomas Kvasthoff meets Johnny Cash?
No, I would not say that. But, you know, I was never a kind of artist who said only classical music is the music. I mean, I love the music, and of course I love Bach and Schubert and Schumann and Brahms and Wolf and everything, but I was always interested in so many other things in literature. And it was really very nice because I had a larynx infection in the last 5 weeks. And all my colleagues said, oh God, you have to stop singing for 5 weeks. And I said, you know what? I bought myself a Kindle thing and I was sitting here and I was reading 5 weeks. I never had the chance really to read in 5 weeks so many books. I loved it. And I cannot remember in the last 15 years that I was at home for 5 weeks, which was very nice. And you know what, with 51, I'm coming to a point in my life where I say everybody is replaceable. Yeah, the music world is not breaking together if Thomas Kvasthoff is not singing. Maybe I'm important for some people who love me, but let's be honest. I mean, the musical world is a very superficial world in many ways. And to be a part of it, it's in a way nice, but I think that I'm not really addicted to it anymore. I love to sing, but if I have not to sing, it's also okay.
Are you aware of the presence that you have on stage, how you dominate a stage? I mean, I've seen you in Salzburg in a Großes Festspielhaus recital with Andras Schiff, and all around me were completely unaware of him. Everything was focused on you. You have this magnetism on stage.
I think it would be really dangerous if I would know it. Mm. Then maybe I would use it more. No, I don't think so. And I think charisma is not learnable. You have it or you don't have it. I can teach a student a vocal technique. I can teach a kind of presence on stage. But charisma you cannot really teach. And thank God I have this talent. I mean, I just had this wonderful example. We had a gala concert from my university where a young singer sang Ella Ja Mai Momo from Don Carlos, where this long prelude orchestral introduction is played. And he was standing honestly like this for 5 minutes. So there was stiff. Nothing mm-hmm. in his face. Zero. Where I said, how is this possible? I mean, if you sing, if you're going to sing, she never loved me, and I don't see this in the face, then something is wrong.
Oh, you do feel that even if it was in the dark and there was no limelight, that you would somehow still attract the limelight.
I mean, there are some instruments that you can use on stage, which is really helping to create a kind of concentration. I mean, for example, to look to one person's eyes, not in the first row, but in the middle, and you're focusing on one person, and it's really giving and creating a feeling that everybody has the feeling that you are meaning him or her, and it works. And the second thing is, I think it's very interesting, to create a kinesthetic space on stage. That means to create a space and to sing so impressive and so imaginative that it doesn't matter in what language you sing, the people have to understand what you are singing about. One of the nicest examples I always have is I had a master class in Salzburg, and one student was singing the trout, the Forelle. And he came on stage and I sang, in einem Bächlein helle, like this. And his face was really up. So I had a key in my hand from the room where I taught, and I smashed it on the floor. And suddenly he did this. I said, exactly. You are not honestly singing about flying fishes. And even if your eye moving, it's not quiet. A trout is doing this. Yeah? Or you can sing duft, but if you sing duft, the audience really have the imagination of smelling something. The way you pronounce words. And I know that I am, in this way, maybe very different from other singers who are much more taking care of having this endless legato. I think Matthias Görner, for example, is an artist like this. For my opinion, this endless legato and smooth sound, the most important thing of his singing. My interests are more in the relation between the music and the language and coloring words, because I think that the human voice is the most colorful voice that you can have from all instruments on earth. So if I would only search for this smooth, that would be not enough from my point of view of art singing. So this is what I try to do as an artist, and this is what I try in making young singers searching for when they study music and when they sing.
Presentation is important. You've criticized other singers, your friend Ian Bostridge, for slouching on stage.
I think if you walk on stage in a recital a lot and even turn away from an audience, what some colleagues are doing, a concentration is lost. And you always see, if you have a Winterreise, for example, and you have these 24 songs, I'm really never let an audience go. Yeah, I really stay between the songs, which leads me really to a point always where you have, after the last song, this total silence where you can really can hear a nail falling. And this kind of concentration is what is, for me, especially in this circle, very, very important. The concentration is getting lost. On the other side, I think that especially my generation of singers and the generation which are really coming after us must think about a new way of presentation, because I really think that this time where lead singing is a synonym for standing on a stage with a frack and having this very serious attitude, instead of also showing people that even for us as artists, it's not this raised finger in, now we are showing you art. Instead of joy and fun. Yeah, I mean, I do, not in the Winterreise, but if I do recitals sometimes, I'm speaking to an audience or making a joke, not on low level, but in a very positive and high level way, a kind of entertainment. I mean, 2 years ago, I sang a really hardcore program for a Salzburg audience. I sang the Rückert songs, then I sang Jedermann Monologue from Frank Martin, then Break, and then I sang a piece by Aribert Reimann, what he wrote for me, 12 minutes unaccompanied, and then the four serious songs from Johannes Brahms. So not really easy listening, definitely not. And it worked, but I also did a joke in between, and I feel always, if I'm doing that, a kind of negative tension is going away. And this generation of Hotter and Dieskau and Schwarzkopf, you know, humor, well, Hotter a little bit, but Dieskau, humor and recitals, I think even the humor was planned.
Would you like to see young singers change the mode of dress or use video?
I don't think that it's a dress question. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would not like to see a recital in jeans or something like this. No, but showing that it's fun what we are doing there, showing that we are enjoying what we are doing there. And every kind of communication with an audience is putting us away from this statue habit. I mean, we had 3 years ago a concert in Verbier, I will not mention her name, by a very, very, very famous soprano. And I admired her always so very much. But then if you realize that the voice is not there anymore, but the habit is really the habit of a diva, then I have problems with this. Yeah, and the presentation was, it was a beautiful looking woman, gorgeous clothing, but she was standing, honestly, the whole evening like that was her presentation. The pianist doesn't exist. The whole piano, can you imagine a big Steinway with was totally closed. Even the part of the piano where you put normally the scores on was closed. So the notes were flat on the piano. And the people after the concert asked me, how was the pianist? I said, honestly, I cannot tell you because I didn't hear him. And this kind of presentation, honestly, I think, is, thank God, is over. She's a very good teacher, by the way. I know that. But honestly, as a singer, I do not want to destroy the beauty of her voice that I have in my mind and that I have heard for many, many years, very often, with the most biggest joy. She was, for me, the Strauss soprano and gorgeous voice. But if it's over, I think it's more or less sad. Yeah.
You've always acknowledged that singing is competitive, that a singer has to find a place on stage and if necessary, fight for a place on the stage. I think you once left an agent because you thought she was favouring another baritone over you because she fancied him.
Yeah, but that would be really easy to say that that was the reason I left the agency, to be honest. It was also a relationship between us which was a little bit complicated. I mean, if you are at the beginning, I mean, then you have honestly to stay in a row. But if you are really established as a singer and you really have the feeling in an agency that another singer is prominently getting the concerts that you would like to sing, from time to time, I would not say always, but maybe one or two, and this is not going to happen, then you definitely have to think about if this is the right time to be at that agency. By the way, I went back then to the agency when another lady overtook her position, and she's now having her own business.
She's Helga Makaj. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm now with her since 6 years, and I love her like a sister. We have not a relationship between normally an artist and an agent. We are very, very, very close friends, and I definitely will finish my career with her as an agent, because she is the best what ever happened to me as an agent and a human being, by the way, too, next to my wife.
When one looks at your range, which is from Bach to Boogie, I always tend to think of Brahms as being somehow at the center of it. I mean, not just that you have this North German